Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming back. How about that? Who's in the fox cabin? Is anybody in the fox cabin? Thanks for buying coffee this morning. I love it. Love it. Thank you so much. So, as I said, every morning we'll talk a little bit about just kind of the behind the scenes of what it's like to be a pastor. So I thought, might be great for my wife, Lynn, to share a little bit on the other side, on the pastor family side. So, oh, here, you should need the microphone.
Good morning. I am not a public speaker, so I'm just going to throw that out there. A question that I get asked a lot is, what is it like to be a pastor's wife? And I stumble over that question a lot. So I have a question for you. What is your ideal or idea of a pastor's wife?
Lonely.
Okay.
Perfect.
Supportive. Oh, come on. Friendly.
Loving.
Submissive. Oh boy, I have a problem. What was the other one?
Behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes, okay. A counselor. Okay, now you're talking my language. I am a school counselor.
Gracious.
Gracious. What?
Human.
Human.
Expected to be involved in the church.
Okay, encourager.
Hospitable.
Wow, that's a lot. I am some of those things, but not all of those things. And I think we all have an idea of the perfect pastor's wife, and we have some that image and those expectations. And I think that if that is what you think of a pastor's wife, all of those different things, then more than likely you're probably going to be disappointed, because those are a lot of things to be and embody, and we're all made unique in God's image. And so each pastor's wife, I believe, does her own thing according to her husband, according to that particular church, according to her own gifts that God has given her. And so early in my journey as a pastor's wife, somebody gave me a book to read about being a pastor's wife, and it was very helpful. Normally, to be honest, I really don't like a lot of women's books, Christian books, but that's just a personal thing. But I really connected with this book. In every chapter, there was a different pastor's wife, showing how pastor's wives could be different. So there was everything from co-pastoring with your husband, so being really involved in the church, to not being involved in the church at all, except as an attender, and everything in between. So the chapter that I identified with was this woman who said her role was to be there for her husband and support her husband. And that's the role that I really try to take on. So I want us to have a good marriage, because I feel when we're connecting really strongly, that allows Jonathan to minister to other people. So at our church, you won't find me involved in a whole lot of ministries, because I spend my time on him. He needs a lot of time.
That's all good.
So my encouragement is that pastors' wives just want to be accepted and loved, and acknowledged for their uniqueness. So that's all I have to say.
Awesome. You can take that with you. Awesome. Hey, that was terrific. How about that? I will say this. I think it's wise when it comes to talking about the pastors' families. It seems like there's usually two extremes that we can err on. And the one side is we can err on the side of putting them up too high, and the other error is too low in a sense, right? And so on the one hand, they're always perfect and they never have mistakes, and we treat them that way or respond to them that way. I think that's very unhealthy because we're human, we're normal, we have issues and all that. But I think it's also wrong to go to the other extreme, like if your kid does something wrong in youth group, oh, we don't want to tell the pastor because that's his kid and something like that. And that's not healthy as well. So it's wise to have a nice, healthy balance in between. It seems to me that some churches and some pastors create that unhealthy environment of those unreasonable expectations. And I see that a lot. I talk with a lot of pastors all the time. And one of the things I hear is like when they're hiring a new staff person, they'll say, you know, hey, Jonathan, it was great because we were able to get two for one. You know, and I'm like, no, that's really an unhealthy thing. You hire one person, and regardless of where the family is, whether or not they're involved, in my opinion, that's an unhealthy thing. If you want to hire the spouse, then you hire the spouse, but you're hiring one person, not the second one. And so sometimes churches create that. Sometimes pastors create that themselves. They enjoy being on the pedestal. They enjoy being above and not having any problems and things like that. And that, to me, that's just, it can tend to be an unhealthy type of a situation. So I appreciate the fact from my wife that she is real and she's authentic and transparent. The pulpit is not a confessional, so every problem that we have does not come out here. But in talking in real life, we're very honest with our struggles in our marriage or mental health or with our child or whatever those types of normal struggles are that we all face. We are normal, regular people. I will say this. One of the things that's really interesting when it comes to the spouse is don't assume that the spouse knows everything that you told the pastor. Does that make sense? Right? So once we were at a funeral, for somebody else, and I wasn't doing the funeral, but so we're talking to this family, and then the wife starts telling my wife all about her husband's prostate issues, right? And this is just, we're just showing up at a funeral, and she's just assuming that my wife would know all these things because they've been telling me all these things, right? Well, there's 900 plus people in our church. I can't tell every problem that comes, you know, from our people to my wife. And then she has her own 400 or so families at her own school that she's trying to be involved with as well. So it's wise to not assume that the pastor's spouse knows everything that you tell the pastor. Does that make sense? Just throwing it out there for that. So enough about that. Let's jump into talking about our Joseph and our man there. You know, I mentioned that I want to open up to questions, that we always have time. If there is any questions, either what we talked about yesterday, or just something else in general that's somewhat theologically related, I'd be happy to try to listen or to answer those. Is there anything that popped from our talk yesterday or just something else that's been somewhat percolating that you want to talk about or throw out there? Yes.
Yesterday you were talking about pastors. You made a comment that many pastors struggle with bitterness.
Oh, sure.
I wondered if you would expound on that.
Sure. It's a very unusual role. It's not a job, it's a role, it's a calling. You can give your whole life to preaching and teaching and loving on your people, and another pastor shows up in town and boom, everyone's over at that church, right? You're just pouring it out and pouring it out, and then somebody will say something to you like, you know, that's really a nice sermon, but I really prefer Charles Stanley and the way he, or Andy Stanley or somebody, you know what I mean, like that. And you're like, I can't compare to somebody like that. I'm just a regular person, you know. And so in that sense, I think bitterness is a, we'll talk actually about bitterness a little bit today in our talk here. But I think a lot of pastors struggle with insecurity, and maybe that's just me, so I'm just extrapolating on everybody else. But the pastors I do know, when we start being honest with each other, insecurity and bitterness are just two real big ones. Part of it is because there's a public image that we put up when you're standing up front. People treat you differently, and we like that. And pastors buy into that and somehow feed that sometimes, and that's also unhealthy, in my opinion, as well. One of my heroes is a guy named Eugene Peterson, and he wrote that the pastor is the easiest job in the world in which to fool people about your own spirituality. All right? How about that one for a dagger to the heart, because who's ever going to call you on the carpet, right? I know Greek and Hebrew, you don't, Right? And so, right, I'm just being honest. And so you're never going to probably call me out and say, are you doing your devotions? Are you praying? Are you doing those things? Are you treating your wife like God tells you to treat your wife? Because we build that wall up. And so because it's an easy job to fool people, I think that root of bitterness can very easily take place in our hearts, at least just from my experience, that's all. Yeah. Yes? Yeah, I'm actually going to talk about that tomorrow or the next day. But I'll tell you this. One of the best things you can do is to give your, in my opinion, give your, the question is, how do we encourage our pastors? To treat them the way that we would want to be treated, which is really simple, but we don't really do that. In terms of giving them the grace to fail and make mistakes, right? So when we go through a failure, everyone in our church knows it. Well, that's a pretty heavy burden to carry. But when you go through failures, it's just you that know it, and the whole church doesn't know it. Well, that's also something that sometimes pastors really long for and desire as well. So just giving our pastors that grace and freedom to be themselves, to fail, to make mistakes. Sincere appreciation is always wonderful. I'll just tell you now. One of the worst things to say to a pastor after they get done preaching is, good sermon. Okay? Because good sermon is like, how you doing? How you doing? Okay, right? We don't care. We're just saying that, right? We don't really mean that. And good sermon, you know, you just poured your heart out for 30 minutes. Hey, good sermon. It's kind of like, good morning. You don't really care. It's just a nice thing to say. And so saying something a little bit more specific, like, oh, I really appreciate that, or that really helped me, or I learned something new, something little like that, sometimes is that goal that we hang on to. So, yeah. I'm not talking for all pastors, I guess. I'm just talking for myself. So any other thoughts, questions? Can we jump in? Yes. The question is, what gives the brothers the right to sell them into slavery? I thought I said easy questions. I think a lot of it goes back into the messed up, dysfunctional family, right? Without that power structure of the father who's in passing upon a God-honoring legacy and lineage, and God telling, you know, Jacob telling the sons, hey, we are here to honor God, and having all of that structure that we are supposed to do as parents and grandparents and building that in, it's total chaos. And so they're doing what they saw their father do, which is be deceitful and lie and scheme. I mean, they lived a whole life of seeing their father just be extremely passive, and I think it was very easy for them just to fall into that same rut. That's just my opinion. That's what makes sense to me. Yeah. Slavery is not like American slavery, totally different, but yeah, sure, slavery was very common. That's good. Good point. So let's jump in. Today we're continuing to talk, great questions by the way, talking about Joseph, his amazing adventures. We're dealing with two different subjects today, kind of pushing them together. We're talking about temptation, specifically the realm of sexual temptation and sexuality, but also applies to broad temptation as well. And then we're talking about how do we feel abandoned, and what do we do when we feel abandoned by God? Something that we usually don't talk about in church, but hey, let's just be honest, and sometimes we do struggle with feeling abandoned by God. Now, when it comes to talking about sexuality, for some reason Christians seem to get a little bit weird about this, and I'm not exactly sure why, okay? The Bible has a very progressive, open, and powerful view of sexuality. I mean, look at the book of Genesis, right? How does God create humans? He creates them naked, and the very first command given to people is be fruitful and multiply, which are nice terms that the King James used to throw in there. The very first command is to have sex. This is how it is in the Bible. Now, when you look at other, oh my word, oh jeez. There's a whole host of other issues there, but we'll deal with those another time, but when you look at other creation accounts, I mean, just go ahead and compare other religions and how other religions view how the gods created humanity, this is totally different than all of those. And so from the Bible's perspective, we're created naked, and the first command given is to have sex. There's an entire book of the Bible dedicated to having sex. It's called the book of the Song of Songs. In fact, in the culture of the day, it's after like Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs. In the culture of the day, 2,000 years ago, you had to be a man over the age of 30 to be able to read that book because it was considered so explicit. Women could not handle it. That's what the historical culture said of that book. It's actually rated R, love poetry. Paul does something very unique in the New Testament, right? In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he's talking about sexuality and marriage and sexuality between a husband and a wife, and he says that the wife's body belongs to the husband, which everyone was shaking their head going, yeah, that's how it is. But then he also says the husband's body belongs to the wife. Now, when Paul says that, the husband's body belongs to the wife, what he is doing there is something that was absolutely radical in the Roman culture of the day, the Greek culture of the day, any culture of the day, because what Paul is saying is there is that the woman has a sexual right that up until that point has been totally denied them by culture. And when we look at that, when people say, oh, the Bible's old-fashioned, the Bible's outdated, usually people that say that, in my opinion, are people that have not read the Bible, okay? Because when we dig into it and actually see what is going on there, it's very powerful and very liberating, in a sense, very modern, and a very radical approach to talking about sexuality. The biblical view of sexuality is that it's good, it's wonderful, it's worship to God, and it's to be enjoyed within the bonds of marriage between a husband and a wife. Sin comes into this world and twists, distorts, turns everything that is good and just puts its own bent on it. And so it twists relationship, it twists work, it twists how we connect with God, and also twists how we are to view sexuality. Within reality, God cares a tremendous amount about our sexuality. And the reason why is because when we are together in the sexual union, it's the closest representation we have of the Trinity. The unity of God, three becoming one. And so the Bible tells us that sex with our spouse is worship to God. And so because it's so powerful and so amazing and so delightful that God puts these rules and boundaries in place, not because God hates us, but because God wants the best for us, for our enjoyment, for our protection, for our benefit. Remember when I was very young and working with the youth group at our church, and I remember talking to this young guy, and he's like, oh, it'd be so great if I could just drive my car without any rules, and I could just go as fast as I want, right? And that's a normal thing for a 16-year-old to say, right? Heaven help us for having 16-year-olds, right? Until you come to that first intersection, right? When it's absolutely chaos. And the reason why those rules are there in those intersections is because there needs to be order so that everyone can get through. Last summer, I had the chance to be in Kenya, and going through these massive intersections in Nairobi, there are no street signs. And so it's 10,000 cars in the center, and everyone is just going an inch at a time, and everyone is moving. I mean, it takes you an hour just to get through a normal intersection because there are no rules. It's just absolute chaos. Those rules are there for our benefit, for our enjoyment, for our protection, for worshiping God. Now, with that in mind, let's open our Bibles to the book of Genesis. Here we are again, Genesis. We'll be there all week. Today, we're in chapter 39. Joseph, as you remember, has been sold into slavery by the brothers. He is now a slave. He finds himself in this guy's house, some dude named Potiphar. We're going to meet his wife. She's unnamed. We call her Polly, right? So Polly Potiphar, that's the wife. We're going to be in Genesis, just keeping you awake, Genesis chapter 39. Follow along as I read just those opening verses. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, oh, that's interesting, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the house of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. Verse 6, and so he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate. In these opening verses, we read not once, but twice, what? The Lord was with Joseph. Now, for somehow, we didn't really see the Lord too much in the previous time, right? I mean, who knows? Joseph was the fancy boy, not working, lounging around the house, tattling on his brothers type of a thing. All of a sudden, for somehow, some way, now God comes in here and God is blessing him. And even Potiphar, this Egyptian dude, realized that the Lord is blessing Joseph. Notice the end of verse 6. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. Actually, this is very rare and very unusual. There's only three times in the entire Bible where these types of descriptions are given of a man. Think about that. One was King Saul. It said that King Saul stood a head taller above the crowd around him. One was of David. David had the ruddy complexion and was beautiful of appearance. And then David's son, Absalom, with the long flowing Fabio hair, right? I mean, these are the only times in the entire Bible where there's some description given to the looks of a guy. So just hang into that, right? He is well built and handsome. Verse 7. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Notice that, verse 10. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her, be around her. Verse 11. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed." Verse 15. "When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home." Verse 17. Then she told him this story. "Hey, that Hebrew slave you brought us, came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." Verse 19. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." The master burned with anger. Verse 20. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Okay, so here's our man Joseph, right? He's far away from home. He's left that messed up family. Everything that he's owned in life, everything that he's had in life, he is totally left behind. He's in a brand new country with a new culture, a new language, new everything around him. Remember, this is our guy with the lame father, the terrible brother, sold as a slave. In a sense, you could say that everything he knew in life that was constricting him is away from him. In some ways, I think this, he had every excuse and the perfect opportunity to sleep with her. Keep in mind, at this point, he's 18, 19 years old. I mean, he was living at home, and now he's in the big city. Think about this. In some ways, it's a no-win situation for Joseph. As a slave, he had to obey her, but as a trustworthy servant of Potiphar, he had to refuse her. The temptation was direct. Look at verse 7 again, right? "Come to bed with me." And then the response was just as direct in verse 8 and 9. "This is a wicked thing, and it's a sin against God." No debating, no flirting, no seeing how far he could go, no moving along in this direction. He had, in all honesty, women, you can close your ears, but guys, he had everything that every man would want, right? Sex without any attachment is available to him. And keep in mind, he's 18, 19. He's tall. He's probably got glasses and a goatee and slightly balding and something like that, right? I mean, it's just, he's all there, okay? Just having fun, okay. Look at verse 9 again. He says, "It's wicked and it's a sin against God." I think it's interesting because it continues on in verse 10. This is continuing day after day after day. It's clear then that Polly sets the trap for him, right? In verse 11, he shows up at the house. Everyone else is gone for the first time. Then she physically grabs him. His response is to turn and run out of the house. This is a theme that is woven through the Bible when it comes to dealing with temptation of any type, not just sexual, but any type, is to run, resist, flee. It's never to play, to touch, to get involved, to see how far, to know where is that line and what is that line that's too much and all those types of things. There's a very consistent pattern that's woven throughout the entire Bible. Run, resist, flee, avoid. Verse 13, she couldn't have him herself, right? And then so she thinks, well, then no one can have him. I'm sure she did scream, but that scream was a scream of rage and not rape. Notice the role of clothing. Hang on to that one, because all throughout the story of Joseph, clothing tells the story of Joseph. She grabs the cloth, his clothes that he has there, and he flees out of the house. Sometimes we say terrible things in church. Let's just be honest, right? We say things like, follow God and everything's going to turn out right. We say things like, just do the right thing and have enough faith and then everything will be just fine in your life. And, you know, just pray together as a couple and you won't have any problems in your marriage. And, you know, just raise your kid right and they'll turn out, you know, terrific. And we say these types of things. And here's a man that is doing everything right and it's all collapsing around him. And it's nothing but tragedy. And we ask ourselves, well, why is God allowing this to happen? I mean, why is God allowing this terrible thing to occur? I think there's a warning here for all of us. It's a warning to not just the young and the up-and-coming, but it's a warning to the person with the education, the intellect, to the woman on that career path, to whoever we're at in life, and that Satan seems to attack us all differently, but he often uses that which what we excel at. Think about that. He attacks us all differently, right? I mean, Satan attacks us all differently. We're all tempted with 1,000 different things. But he always tends to use that thing that we excel at, whatever that thing is, our looks, our skills, our intelligence, our wealth, our education, our success, or whatever those things are, that always seems to be the thing that Satan uses to attack us. And so the story continues here, right? She screams for her husband. Her husband says something. I think verse 19 is interesting. At least for me, it's interesting. It says that when the master heard this, he burned with anger. The literal translation, right, is that his nose burned red. It's that image we think of the cartoon bull, right, with the steam coming out and the nose and the anger and all those types of things. But if Potiphar, here's a question, if Potiphar is the chief of the guards, if he's the head of the executioners, why didn't he just kill Joseph? This is something I've thought of. I mean, it's your job, killing people. Who is he angry at in verse 19? We don't know. Oh. Maybe he's angry at his wife. Maybe this is a continual story. He's dealt with this time after time after time again. And maybe that's why he doesn't kill Joseph. He seems to be taking the minimal action while still keeping his family's honor. Maybe it's because he didn't fully trust or believe Polly. Joseph is not killed, but he's placed in the king's prison. Look at the end of chapter 39. But the Lord was with him, Joseph. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. And so the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison. And he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Again, Joseph now is in charge. Now he's in charge in just a whole new location, right? Now he's just in another confinement. He was in the pit. Now he's in the jail, but he's in charge of that. There's one little thought here that I have for you, and you can see it behind me on this slide. It talks about fulfilling our divine destiny requires obedience to God. It's just an important truth there, I think, for all of us. This is what we want to pass along to our children. This is why we tell our kids to follow God and to do the right things and to obey. Is that there is a divine destiny that is woven into the story of Joseph here. And he knows for some reason that God has some plan in place. He's remembering those dreams he had 2 or 3 years earlier where the family is bowing down to him and everyone's bowing down to him. And because of that obedience to God, then he has to say no to these other things around him. He is saying no to these temptations. While this is a story about sexual temptation, it applies to all of us in general when it comes to temptations. This is why we talk about it now. This is why we prepare ourselves now ahead of time. This is why we talk about these things and be sure to be alert for those dangers that come. When not only do we prepare ourselves now, one of the things I think I've learned is that when we fight alone, we die alone. Does this make sense? And so when we are struggling with something, the most important thing that any one of us can do is go to somebody else and say, I am struggling with this. Can you help me? And go to your pastor. Go to somebody here at Four. Go to somebody to come alongside of us to say, hey, I am struggling with this. But we had an interesting thing happen in one of our elder meetings just a few weeks ago. One of the elders shared that he was struggling with depression. And it was kind of like, whew. You know, we don't really talk about mental health issues anywhere, let alone in a religious setting, because that's not, you know, not something we talk about. All of a sudden, two other elders started to share their stories as well. And they go, yeah, I've been struggling with this too. And another guy said, yeah, I've really had that my whole life, and I've been struggling with that as well. And I was like, oh my word. When we fight alone, we die alone. But when we talk and be open with what is going on, we start to find out there's other people around us that have the exact same things going on as well. And then we can help encourage and pray together as well. Joseph here is facing with this temptation, and he says that it's a sin against God because it violates God's boundaries of sexual expression for us. And it's just a powerful little reminder for us of what happens to us when we withstand that temptation. We keep ourselves on track for that divine destiny that God has for us. And it's a powerful story here in chapter 39 of Joseph modeling for us what it means to stand up against temptation. Keep in mind, temptation does not come from God, right? James chapter 1, temptation comes from our own desires, which entice us and drag us away. I'm going to continue. I want to shift focus. I want to jump into chapter 40 as we continue to run through the life of Joseph. I want to talk a little bit now. We talked about temptation. I want to talk a little bit about feeling abandoned. I think all of us, if we're honest, at some point in our life will say that we feel abandoned. Maybe it's a family hardship that we're going through, a relationship that's in crisis. It's a health concern that's pressing upon us. Sometimes we feel it with our jobs. So many of us struggle with anxieties and fears. I've heard from a lot of people in our church that have this massive anxiety about what's going to happen to our nation with the upcoming election and politics and things like that, and we feel dread and despair. And then on top of just feeling abandoned, then we add the whole religion angle into it. Sometimes we feel that God has left us and we're mad at God. But then we say to ourselves, well, we can't actually say that, right? We have to pretend that we're good followers of Jesus and think that everything is going well, but we can never be honest and say, you know, God, why have you abandoned me? It seems inappropriate to admit something like that. One of the things that I've learned is my job as a pastor is just to speak honestly and to speak truth into our people. It's far easier to talk about nicer subjects, right? Three ways to have a better marriage and two ways to have a better prayer life and things like that. But we also need to deal with the more difficult subjects. Like, what do we do when we feel abandoned by God? I've got some thoughts here, and you see these four things behind me. These are, I think, four truths that apply for every single one of us, right? We will suffer. We are bad at it. But we can prepare ahead of time. And God uses pain to shape us. These are just some opening thoughts as we're delving into the subject of feeling abandoned. The first one, we will suffer. This is just reality, right? It's a reality for every one of us except for just a few select people, it seems like. But the reality is that every single one of us will go through those hardships in our life. We all will suffer. I do think that we are bad at it. I'm not talking about you specifically. I'm talking about somebody else, okay? But in general, we are bad at it. When it comes our way, it surprises us, it scares us, we're afraid, we don't know what to do. The good news is that we can prepare ahead of time. That's why we talk about this, that's why we dig into God's Word, because it gives us hope and encouragement, remember? And I think there's a powerful lesson there, that God can use pain to shape us. Now hang on to those things as we continue with our study in Joseph. Remember the role of the clothing of Joseph. The clothing of Joseph tells the story. We saw him yesterday with the fancy boy robe. He was at home. Then, you know, today he's in his worker clothes. So he's wearing the dockers and the polo in Potiphar's house. Now he's in the orange jumpsuit. He's in prison. This is a guy who knows what it's like to feel abandoned. Again, I have not seen, I feel like I'm the only one that has not seen the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, but there's a line in that musical when Joseph is in prison where the narrator says to Joseph, don't despair, I have read the end of the story and everything turns out okay, right? Now, that's good for us, but that's not good for Joseph. He's in the middle of it. He has no idea what is going to happen to him. He is just stuck in prison. As we continue and we read and as we dig into this story, we find that he spends 10 years in prison. Just hang on to that fact. If anyone can speak about being a victim, if anyone can speak about the unfairness in life, if anyone could talk about being abandoned, it's our man Joseph. He had the passivity of his fathers, the jealousy of his brothers, thrown into the pit, sold as a slave. Then he's the victim of the false accusation by his boss's wife. Now he's thrown into prison even though he is innocent. And then what about those dreams? I mean, I thought those dreams came from God or somebody where everyone is bowing down to. Here's a truth that I would love for you to write down. I'm just going to tell it to you. Satan uses adversity to break us. God uses it to shape us. Satan uses adversity to break us. God uses it to shape us. Boy, if there's anything I could implore upon you to hang on to this week, it's that. Satan uses adversity to break us. God uses it to shape us. When we saw Joseph last, he was in the prison. At the end of chapter 39, it says the Lord was with him, not once, not twice. Which sounds good, but you're still in prison, okay? Yeah, oh, that's something to hang on to. You're still in prison. I thought you were doing the right thing. But for some reason, God is drawing near to him in prison. And we can dig into Joseph's mind and we can identify with him. Where are you, God? God, why are you allowing this to happen? You know, if you are so powerful, then what are you doing about my situation? Why do I deserve this? Now, jump into the story. Look at Genesis chapter 40 as we read what happens now in prison. Sometime later, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody of the captain of the guard in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. And then we'll just stop right there. Okay, so sometime later, a few years go by of silence, of nothing. It's the monotony of prison life. Pharaoh's bartender and Pharaoh's baker are sent to prison. These two have a very close relationship with Pharaoh. It's a position of trust and respect. They're the ones giving him the food and the drink. We're not sure why these two were sent into prison. The Bible doesn't tell us. I can assume that the baker made a terrible fruitcake, right? And the bartender served some type of light beer, and so that was it, off to prison. For whatever reason, they ended up in prison. They were assigned to Joseph. And remember, God is with Joseph. Now this morning, we talked about temptation, but we're also talking about feeling abandoned. And I've got these points, and you see them, first one behind me. Adversity can make us aware of others who are hurting. It can make us aware of others who are hurting. One of the ways that God can shape us when we face adversity is that can make us more aware of other people who are hurting with the exact same thing around us. Here, Joseph is in prison. He's in despair. He's abandoned by everything. He meets two other people in a very similar situation, and the Bible tells us that he befriends them and he cares for them because he understands what they are going through. Joseph begins a relationship with these two. Why? Because he had a focus on God. He was not bitter. He was not filled with anger or rage towards his father or his brothers or his boss's wife or Pharaoh. One of the ways that God can shape us is that we can become aware of others who are hurting around us. I'm just throwing it out. It's not why we go through the bad thing. It's just one of those ways that God can shape us to make us aware of others who are hurting as well. Now jump back into our story. Look at the middle of verse 4. After they had been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were being held in the prison, had a dream the same night. Each dream had a meaning of its own. When Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. And so he asked the Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in his master's house, "Why are your faces so sad today?" "Well, we both had dreams," they answered, "but there was no one to interpret them." Then Joseph said, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams." Verse 9. So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said, "In my dream, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches, and as soon as it budded, it blossomed, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cups, and put the cup in his hand." "Well, this is what it means," verse 12, Joseph said to him. "The three branches are 3 days, and within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand, just as you used to when you were his cupbearer. But when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. For I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews, and even though I have done nothing to deserve being put here in a dungeon." When the baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, "Hey, I too had a dream. On my head were three baskets of bread, and the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket of my head." Verse 18, "Well, this is what it means," Joseph said. "The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and hang you on a tree or on a pole, and the birds will eat away your flesh." Well, good night to you. Sweet dreams. Okay. What do we do when we read this story to our kids? I mean, do we just skip over this part? I mean, this is what it's talking about here. We'll just pause right here. Okay, so both of these two officials had the odd dreams. It left them confused, naturally, and concerned. Joseph is saying, "Hey, I've had some experience with dreams," right? He's going back to those two dreams he had 3 or 4 years earlier that he told to his family. That turned out well. Verse 8, don't the interpretations belong to God? Hey, God knows all things. God can help. And so the bartender tells him his dream first, right? The grapevine grew grapes, put them into the magic juicer. Pharaoh drank it. Joseph says, this is good news. You're going to get your job back. Verse 14 and 15 is actually the center key passage in this chapter. The whole focus of the chapter is on verses 14 and 15. Just remember me. Whatever happens to you, just please don't forget who I am. I've been forgotten enough by everybody and everything in life. Just please remember my name. Don't forget me. The baker hears this. The baker tells him his dream as well, carrying the baskets of bread. Joseph says, oh, bad news for you. Your head's going to get chopped off. Your body's going to be on a pole, and birds are going to eat you. God gives Joseph the ability to interpret these dreams. A few days go by. Look at verse 20. Now the third day was Pharaoh's birthday, and he gave a feast for all his officials. He lifted up the heads of the cupbearer and the baker in the presence of his officials. He restored the cupbearer to his position so that he once again put the cup in the Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged or put on a pole the baker, just as Joseph had said to them in his interpretation. The cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. So, big birthday party for Pharaoh. We can imagine what is going on here, right? Big pyramid bouncy houses, right, everywhere. The Bengals are playing their hit song. Oh, you are good people. That's right. Walk Like an Egyptian, 1986, right? So that's playing. The bartender is brought back into service. The baker is killed, just as Joseph has said. At this point, Joseph is thinking to himself, I've got an in to the man, right? I've got the baker. He is there. I've got my golden ticket. I've got my access to the king. My days in prison are numbered. In verse 23, the cupbearer did not remember. Those days stretched to weeks, to months, to years, and silence, and nothing happens. Every time we seem like we see Joseph, the story always ends on a negative note, right? The first time we see him, he's shuffling off in slavery. We see him with Potiphar's wife. He's being sent to prison. Here in chapter 40, it ends with being sent and left in prison, rotting away again. We've been with Joseph for only 2 days, but this theme of abandonment is actually woven through Joseph's story. The Bible tells us that he spends 10 years in prison. Think about this. Abandoned by everyone around him. He's probably now in his late 20s. He's in the prime of his life, right? Reaching his full looks, his earning potential, his skill. It's supposed to be the best decade of his life, and he's rotting away in prison. And even though he's abandoned by everything around him, he begins to see God at work. Twice in the beginning of chapter 39 and the end, it says that the Lord was with him. He finds favor in the eyes of the warden. He's put in charge of the prison. He's given the ability to interpret these dreams of the bartender and the baker. And Joseph does something extraordinary. He keeps that focus on God, regardless of the circumstances, and God is using him while he is in prison. Since coming to Egypt, Joseph has done everything right. He's worked hard for Potiphar. He's worked hard in prison. He's earned the respect of the warden. He showed compassion to the fellow prisoners. He's trusted in God to provide the answer to their dreams. And then he's honest, which is a tough one, with the interpretation of the dreams. And the result of Joseph's obedience to God is nothing. It's silence. It's abandonment. He's in prison for 10 years. And this is where Joseph's story from 4,000 years ago intersects with our stories today, because undoubtedly we too feel abandoned by God. We feel abandoned maybe by our spouse or our friends, by society, culture, by God himself. So many of us carry those wounds around from past relationships, and we're just upset with what God has done for us, done to us. And this is how we identify with Joseph. Because we know what it's like when those circumstances oppress us, even though when we're trying to do the right thing. Now, I'm telling you, my friends, that Satan uses adversity to break us, but God uses it to shape us, right? We've already seen how adversity can make us more aware of others who are hurting. You see that middle one there. We can choose. We can choose bitterness or trust. We may not have control over our circumstances. In reality, we have very little control over our circumstances, right? In reality, we have extremely little control over what happens to us in life. But we do have a tremendous amount of control with God's help over our response. Joseph has no control over almost his entire life. In prison for 10 years, passive father, Polly tempting him, the murderous brothers. He can't control that the bartender forgot him. But Joseph has a tremendous amount of control with God's help over his response. He leans into God. He decides to trust God. We know, let's be honest, we know people who have chosen the path of bitterness, right? And we don't want to be around those people. They're toxic. It's tough to be around them. And sometimes we see them coming and we want to avoid them. Bitterness comes in our life when we put our hope in anything other than God. Think about that. We put our hope in our relationship and it starts to fail us. That's when bitterness starts to take root. We put our hope in our country or our politics or power or looks or our skills, our health, our jobs, our kids. Whatever we put our hope in that's other than God, that's when bitterness begins to take its roots in our life. And Joseph, in spite of his circumstances, chooses to trust in God. It doesn't mean that everything's going to work out great. It doesn't mean that his life is going to be perfect. In fact, he spends over 12 years in prison. But trusting in God means we have a power that's greater than the power that is out there. We have the power of the living God who is alive and in us ourselves. As I was preparing for this talk, I read about a man by the name of Christian Reger. Christian Reger was a man that decided to trust in God instead of taking the path of bitterness in his life. Christian Reger grew up in Nazi Germany. He was a part of the church that was willing to stand up against Hitler and the Nazis' rise to power. Another member of the church turned him into the Nazis. Think about that. Christian Reger spends 4 years in the Dachau prison concentration camp, experiencing the worst evils of humanity. And he survived that time. And when he talked about that time, he said this, "I've learned a lot about God in my life. He sustained me then, and he is enough to sustain me still." There's a powerful truth there. I think it's where it connects with our story of Joseph. Joseph calls out to us, when we feel abandoned in life, we can choose to trust in God, even when our circumstances scream against it. Even when life doesn't make sense to us, we lean into him and we trust in him. The last point there, I think, is a helpful one for all of us. Jesus proves to us that God hasn't abandoned us. The greatest proof that God has not abandoned us, that he sent his son Jesus into this world. Jesus, who came to earth on the greatest rescue mission of all time. Jesus is proof that God has not abandoned us. Jesus is proof that we have a God that cares about us. Jesus is proof that we have a God who identifies with us. Wasn't Jesus himself abandoned by his family and friends and those he invested in the most? Wasn't it Jesus on the cross crying, "God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus is proof that we have a God who understands abandonment. And so we look at our story of Joseph, and Joseph is calling out to us from prison. He's calling out to every single one of us here this morning. And he's telling us that adversity can make us aware of others who are hurting. It can open our eyes to other people that are going through that same struggle. Joseph is calling out to us and telling us that we can choose. We can choose bitterness, or we can choose to trust in God. And I'm here to tell us all that Jesus proves to us that God has not abandoned us. I am convinced that Satan uses adversity to break us, but God can use those exact same difficult things that we all go through in life to shape us and to form us into his image. God was there with Joseph when he was abandoned in prison. God was there with Christian Reger when he was abandoned in the Dachau concentration camp. And that same God is here for you and I, my friends. Satan will use abandonment to break us, but God will use it to shape us. Let's go before the Lord and end our time in prayer. Lord, this is powerful and this is challenging and this is convicting. It's convicting for me. I realize, Lord, how in my life it's so easy to trust in myself, to trust in my skills, whatever they are, to trust in my own abilities, Lord. Lord, it's easy for that bitterness to take root when I see others that are succeeding, when I see others that have it all together, when I see all these other things, Lord. Lord, I am so thankful for the hope and the encouragement that comes from your word and from our man, Joseph, who stood firm against the temptations that were around him, who realized, Lord, that by giving into those temptations, he was doing a disservice to you, most importantly. Lord, we all go through those abandonments, and we all go through those times in our life, and we all go through those adversities. And I pray, Lord, that you will not allow Satan to use those things to destroy us, but Lord, that you can come into our life and use those negative, terrible things that we go through to shape us, to make us more into the image of your Son. Lord, this is difficult for all of us, and that's why you've called us here together as a group, as a community. That's why you've called us to your church, Lord. Lord, help us to model this transparency and model the brokenness and model our dependence on you. And it's in Jesus' name that we pray these things. Amen.